So we're going to get started. We will start with a work session on Senate Bill 16. Mr. Putman, can I say this?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, you heard this bill the other day. It was scheduled then only for a public hearing. Senator Yee presented the dash two and the dash three amendments. Just to recap very briefly, the dash two directed the President of the Senate and the Speaker of the House to choose one of the business members to be the executive director. And the dash three increases the size of the committee to a maximum of 21. It basically allows the co-chairs to choose an elected official, state official, who is elected, if they want to. Those are the two amendments.
Thank you, Mr. Putman. Senator Wardley.
Mr. Chair, I would move the dash three.
We'll do more.
Sure, that's fine.
I'll move the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 16.
Senator Wardley moves the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 16. Discussion, objections, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash three amendments to Senate Bill 16.
Senator Wardley moves the dash three amendments to Senate Bill 16. Discussion, objections, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 16 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Wardley moves Senate Bill 16 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion. Any objections? So ordered. Senators Harper and Deckard are excused. If they're some of the members, let them. Harper's still in committee. And I was thinking the same thing. We'll ask Senator Yee to carry the bill, unless someone on the committee has a burning desire to do so.
Senator Atkinson.
Burning desire, and look at me, sure.
No.
They have medication for that. You know, too.
We'll let Senator, if Senator Yee chooses not to, then we'll assign someone else. We'll let Senator Yee.
If she chooses not to, then I'd like to carry it.
Senator Gordy will carry it if she doesn't want to.
Sure.
Close the work session on Senate Bill 316.
16, you mean?
16, excuse me. I would like to wait on 485 until we have as much of a full committee as we can, so.
Yes.
So we will first go to a work session on Senate Bill 316. Open the work session. Mr. Putman?
Mr. Chairman, when we had the public hearing, there was no one, we didn't take any testimony before the hearing was closed. I don't know if you want to invite some testimony or not today.
Yes, I would like to have John Schultz come up. And is Nancy here also? Okay. Please come up.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this bill simply clarifies the time limits for filing a particular type of aggregation claim in workers' compensation cases.
Okay, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is John Schultz. I'm the administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division, and to my right, your left, is Nancy Bieber, the manager of our dispute resolution section. And I asked Nancy actually to deliver the testimony today because I think she's far more conversant with this than I am, and I think she can do it in a quick and conversational way.
Thank you. Quick and conversational workers' comp discussion. Wow.
Do my best for the record.
Law school. Sorry.
Just ignore him. Go ahead, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Nancy Bieber. What Senate Bill 316 does is a technical fix that brings two different sections of the statute into conformance with each other because currently they are not in conformance with each other. When an insurer accepts a workers' compensation claim, they classify it as either a disabling claim or a non-disabling claim. If it's non-disabling, the worker's entitled to medical treatment only and their medical bills are paid. If it's disabling, they're entitled to temporary total disability payments or partial disability payments and or permanent disability payments. So there are some fairly significant differences between what a worker can get. We had two sections of the law that cover reclassification. One provides a year after claim acceptance to request reclassification of the claim, and the other allows the year or 60 days after first classification, whichever is later. So no one knows what to do when a worker requests a reclassification. This bill would make both sections consistent and make it up to 1 year after the first classification of the claim as non-disabling. The other problem with the current bill has to do with the period of aggravation rights. When a worker's claim first becomes medically stationary, they're entitled to a period of aggravation rights, which is the period during which they can request their claim be reopened if their condition has become substantially worse. And in a case where the claim was originally non-disabling and later becomes disabling, the current statute doesn't make it clear when the aggravation period runs. On this non-disabling claims, they run 5 years from the date of injury. On disabling claims, they run 5 years from the date of first claim closure, which could be months or years later. So again, it makes a difference. And what this bill does is make it clear that if the claim was not reclassified during that 1 year period that the bill now provides, the aggravation rights will always be as for a non-disabling claim 5 years from the date of original injury. So that's basically what it does.
Okay.
If you have any questions, I'll be happy to try and answer them.
You may know how long ago it was originally adopted.
Pardon me?
How long ago this was originally adopted? Does anybody know when the statute was originally or last changed?
Mr. Chair, yes, it was last changed in Senate Bill was 220 last session. And the reason it was changed then was under the statute as it was, there was sometimes no provision for a worker to request reclassification of his claim. The law provided that it had to be done within a year of the date of injury, whether or not the insurer had ever classified the claim. So there were situations when the claim hadn't even been classified as non-disabling before the right to challenge that had expired. But somehow or another, when the change was made, it was made differently in the two different sections.
So we made it crystal clear 2 years ago, and now we have to come back and re-clarify it.
That's exactly right, Mr. Chair.
I was afraid of.
Hurry, wait on the next session.
Thank you very much. Any other questions? Well, go ahead. Isn't a public hearing? We're not in a public hearing. We're in a work session. For your information, the MLAC, Management Labor Advisory Committee, has approved this bill and recommends its approval.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 316 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Gordon moves Senate Bill 316 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion on the bill or the motion? Any objections? So ordered. Any volunteers to carry?
Okay.
Senator Harper will carry. And Senator Deckard is excused. Did he indicate when he was going to get here?
Apparently he was on the road moving.
I don't have to carry 485. Okay.
Okay. Wasn't my day to
come. I know what I'm going to add.
Ryan wanted to wait.
He didn't indicate anything.
Okay.
Let me get a better feel for that.
Want to hear a good Irish joke while we're waiting?
Well, we could. That's a loaded question, Tony.
He didn't tell me.
His L.A. call. He doesn't have a...
So the Pope and the Queen are sitting there.
We will open a work session.
huge audience. And the Queen says, you know, I can create a howl of activity by all the Englishmen out there by just simply one wave of my hand. And the Pope says, that's pretty interesting. Let me see that. And she goes... And the whole crowd erupts and applauds. And the Pope says, well, I can do more than that. I can get everybody excited and get them hollering and screaming with one move of my hand. And she goes, well, how would you do that? He slapped her.
Thank you for that enlightenment. We will open a work session on Senate Bill 485.
That'll liven up these workers' comp things, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
I think we ought to do a routine here.
I think you just did.
That'd be covered. That'd be covered. You'd get an inch.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I sent to you earlier today a -3 amendment, which was the product of our earlier work on the -1. Shortly after it was printed, a problem was discovered on page 45, and that has been fixed in the -4. So everything that you've said and heard about the -3 was also true of the -4, with the exception of about 4 lines on page 45. And so the little roadmap I gave you is still accurate, and Mr. Schultz will just deal with that. I've asked him to be here today to try to answer questions if you may have. If you have others here who may wish to testify as well, we'll be invited to testify.
Okay. Does anyone have any questions of Mr. Schultz on the -4 amendments now that we are speaking of, not the -3s. Apparently no one has any questions of Mr. Schultz. We are in work session. From my understanding, John, why don't you just come up a moment. In a conversation I had with Mr. Schultz just prior to the committee starting, there have been some technical difficulties also discovered with the -4s. I think at this point in time, we need to keep this bill moving, so I've talked with the chairman of the House committee that will be reviewing this bill, and he is open to fixing any technical problems the bill may have between and any more that may crop up between now and then. John, you want to quickly go through, if you think we should, for the record, show what those technical amendments are that you have come forward or found in the last few minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm John Schultz, Administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division. Shortly before this committee meeting started, it was brought to my attention that in what would be, let me make sure I'm referencing the right version of the bill here, in the -4 version of the bill, on page 7, starting on line 18, which is subsection 30 of the definition section of the bill, that a reference that was in the original 485 and was also in the -1 version of the 485 regarding the definition of the worker is no longer here. And the reference basically started right on line 25 right after the word grant and states, for the purpose of determining entitlement to temporary disability benefits or permanent total disability benefits under this chapter, worker does not include a person who is withdrawn from the workforce for the period for which such benefits are sought. what that language was trying to get to was to make it very clear that if a worker has withdrawn from the workforce, is no longer basically in the workforce, that they are not entitled to temporary total disability benefits or permanent total disability benefits. There is a like reference that is in the in a later portion of the bill. That reference mirrors existing case law, was discussed by the task force, was discussed by MLAC, was always intended to be part of the bill, and I think it should be part of the bill. I can't explain to you why it's not. It just was brought to my attention, and quite honestly, I don't know what happened to that. It might have been something that inadvertently hit the cutting room floor, for all I know.
John, so the language that I'm looking at now in the dash one amendment, the bold language in subsection 30 on page 7, is the exact language that we would like to have in the bill.
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other, and that was the only piece, right? There aren't any other errors with the dash four that you're aware of at this point in time.
As Mr. Chair, I think that there's going to be additional technical issues that people will continue to bring forward with this bill. Today at MLAC, I had a couple of people bring forward issues and say this would improve it. From my perspective, I agree with a lot of the things that I've seen, but these are issues that I think have to be reviewed by people other than me. The folks that put this bill together need to be consulted. And what we did when we put the dash threes and dash fours together is that in any language change that we made, we went back and consulted with the people who originated the amendment to make sure they were comfortable with what we were doing, including that dash four amendment. So I honestly feel the right answer to your question is no, I think there'll be more technical amendments to come on the House side. But do I think that I would sit here and wish to represent everything accurately? I don't think that's a fair thing to do.
Okay, now that's fair enough. Just so we know that right now that there isn't anything else that we know of. But and for the committee's attention, there's also an issue on, I think it's still section 14, dealing with the interim meds that is not addressed, that I thought was addressed. I think the committee thought was addressed with any additional cost to the interim med piece to the system would be spread system-wide, not covered industry-specific. I've had conversations with members of MLAC who thought it was addressed, and it's not in this draft. So I've also talked to the House Chair about that issue, and he's agreed to bring up that issue also. And John has indicated they're working on some language still to address that piece. So this bill will be amended in the House, but I think we've got the best product we can right now. I think because we have the language in front of us that we need in the bill for this specific piece, I'm going to amend the dash fours, or I'm going to recommend we amend the dash fours by moving the bold language of subsection 30 on page 7 from the dash 1s into the dash 4s. So the chair would move that we amend the dash 4s with, first we have to move to suspend the rules probably, huh? I guess we've got a legislative council version in front of us, so we do have the amendment. So the chair would move that.
Let's do it quick before Judy gets down here.
The chair would move that we amend the dash four amendment.
The chair's not going to move, right?
The chair is moving it.
Oh, I thought you couldn't.
No, I believe I can.
Anybody can. Fine, it's your fault then.
Okay. The chair moves we amend the dash four amendments on page 7 by inserting the bold language as seen on the dash one amendments, page 7, lines 23 through 26. Is there any discussion on the motion? Any objections? So ordered. We now accept the amendment on the dash four amendment.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash four amendment as amended to Senate Bill 485.
Senator Gordley moves the dash four amendment as amended by the committee to Senate Bill 485. Is there discussion on the motion? I think we for the record, we think we've already had some discussion, and I appreciate everyone's patience and work on this bill, especially the people out here that have done most of the heavy lifting. Any objections to the motion? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate.
One more. Senator Atkinson?
Is this dash two I have from a few meetings ago? Is this the one we were discussing?
Yes.
I have a particular interest in moving the dash two amendment, so I make that motion, Mr. Chair.
Senator Atkinson moves the dash two amendments into Senate Bill 485 for the committee's information. The dash two amendments are the amendment is the amendment that would put the sunsets that are currently in the law back into the law, into the bill. Would you like to discuss your motion, Senator Atkinson?
And that date is when?
The sunset date?
Yes.
Currently 2004. Would you like to discuss to your motion?
I think we've talked about the dog for a long time.
Okay. I would like to address the motion. I have listened to all sides of this debate, and I understand where Senator Atkinson is on this, and I personally agree with him that with the Supreme Court case that's out there right now that's holding over the heads of the entire workers' comp system, this amendment would be a good addition to the bill. So, with that, anybody else? Any other discussion on the motion?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Harper.
I appreciate where you're coming from, but I think I can't go with you. So I'll be a no on this. We just need to get this thing moving without this.
Okay.
I, too, would be a no.
No.
Well, I guess we'll call for the vote. Please call the roll.
Senator Corcoran?
No.
Senator Geffert? Senator Gordley?
No.
Senator Hopper?
No.
Senator Starr?
No.
Senator Barr?
I think you better call Senator Atkinson.
Senator Atkinson?
Yes.
Senator Barr?
Aye. Motion fails. Senator Gordley?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 485 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Senator Gordley moves Senate Bill 485 as amended by the committee to floor with a do pass recommendation. Before we have a vote on the bill, we need to have some legal jargon put into the record. We call Mr. Jerry Keene forward to do that. And this
legal jargon? What have we been doing?
This is
we've been talking English in this place for 6 weeks.
If you need a break, this may be a time to take it. It's not going to be a short legal jargon.
I agree with you.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Jerry Keene. I'm an appellate lawyer that specializes in workers' comp, and particularly appellate workers' comp, and has for the last 20 years in that capacity. I was involved in the drafting of the Senate bills that passed, or the House and Senate bills that passed in 1990 and 1995, and then had the good fortune to watch what the courts did to the language we chose by being over there while they were doing it, and we learned some lessons. One lesson was that you have to come and make a very thorough record in front of the committee on what is intended in places where the bill might be considered ambiguous. The second is that you've got to do it orally or it doesn't have the same impact. We spent a half hour in excruciating detail on this with Senate Bill 369. The committee members were in pain, but the court later on ended up citing that over and over and over again as the most valuable testimony in terms of interpreting it. So my goal is to be conversational and to use jargon at the same time. I'm going to keep an eye on Senator Corcoran. If I lose him, I figure I've lost everybody. But I would
still my lips.
I do invite questions, but I'm going to go through this, not every section. I will not be repeating things that I've been watching very closely. I've watched the hearings testimony. I'm not going to say things I think have already been made a record upon. I'm just going to focus on things that bear further light when we go to litigate this later on. I'll go section by section, but not on every section. And also, at the end of each section, if you'd like to ask questions, I'd be glad to entertain those, but probably will go better if we don't do questions in the middle of each section. But at the end of each section, I'll stop and see if there's any questions.
Are you working off the dash fours?
I'm working off the dash fours.
Okay.
The ones that most recently occurred. And first of all, most of my comments, the bulk, are going to be on Section 1, which is the one that I expect to see the most ambiguity perceived by the courts and the most need for some interpretation. This addresses combined condition claims in the jargon, injuries that are sustained by a worker on a body part to which a pre-existing condition also contributes, the two of them causing the disability and need for treatment. In that situation, the courts draw the line down the middle currently and the statute. If it's more than half work-related, it's in the system. If it's more than half non-work-related, it's not in the system. And in the non-work-related side, the courts weigh pre-existing conditions as causes to decide which is the major contributing cause, work or non-work. What this bill does is say carve out of that definition of a pre-existing condition those conditions which do not actively contribute to the disability or need for treatment involved in an active way, but instead, if they are merely predisposing factors, and the doctors think they know what they mean by those terms, they are no longer to be considered pre-existing conditions and no longer weighed on the non-work side of the ledger. Currently, the law defines pre-existing conditions as traits, characteristics, but asymptomatic conditions such as age, gender, weight, history of smoking, alcohol use, abuse, family history, some congenital factors. Those are all deemed pre-existing conditions that don't actively contribute, but still are deemed causes under the current law. Under the new law, they won't. Anticipate I'll need that, do you? Can I have some of what you've got, Senator?
This is really old coffee. You're welcome to it.
Section 1 accomplishes that change by eliminating the verb predisposes from the definition of a pre-existing condition. This is on page 6, line 5, and it also disappeared from the language in line 22. And the courts will deem that significant, and it was on purpose. This verb was added to the statutes to head off a line of cases in 1995. That were exemplified by Liberty Northwest versus Spurgeon and Portland Adventist versus Buckaloo. Spurgeon determined that predisposing factors did not constitute causes and couldn't be weighed. And Buckaloo said, and you have to decide whether something is a predisposing factor or a cause in every case, case by case, with no general rule to help it out just based on the medical evidence in each case. This change will take us back to the pre-1995 change, and we'll bring back Spurgeon and Buckaloo and the need to litigate the difference between predisposing factors and pre-existing conditions in every case where it matters, with one important difference. The language includes a phrase that was put in quite definitely on purpose, and it states, and it's a legal principle to guide the courts in trying to draw the line between pre-existing conditions and predisposing factors. And that principle is that a condition does not contribute to disability or treatment if it merely renders the worker more susceptible to the injury. This is intended to draw a line, and the word merely is critical because it emphasizes that the distinction turns on the difference between active and passive contribution. This tells the courts that any condition or factor that whose only contribution is to make the worker more susceptible to the injury, those are predisposing factors, don't weigh them. If it does anything more, they're a pre-existing condition, and weigh them. And that's what that phrase is for. When the courts wonder what that line is for, it was to help them draw a line. And this active-passive distinction, I think, is the most critical one. It sets up a distinction between passive contributors such as age, gender, obesity, smoking, and active ongoing contributors to damage in the body part involved, like previous injuries or diseases, degenerative conditions, diabetes, presbycusis, conditions that have their own independent, active, pathological impact on the body part. If they do not, if they merely rendered the worker more susceptible to the injury that occurred, then it's a predisposing factor and should not be weighed as a cause. I won't belabor that further. The second major change in injury claims requires that a pre-existing condition need to have been diagnosed or treated before a certain point in time, or it doesn't constitute a pre-existing condition that gets weighed. The critical part about this is that there's language in there that says if the worker has treated for the condition before, even though the doctors did not then understand what was causing that symptom, it is still a pre-existing condition. It does not have to have been correctly diagnosed. It merely has to have manifested in symptoms that the worker sought treatment for. And there's a parallel to other lines of cases in the law of responsibility that are exemplified by Safe versus Kelly, a 1994 case. It's the same reasoning. And then, of course, this particular aspect applies to injury claims, not occupational disease claims. Third, arthritis or arthritic conditions have been exempted from that last change I just discussed. It is not defined, and that's on purpose. MLAC declined to define the phrase arthritis or arthritic symptoms because they couldn't agree on wording to codify it. The discussions of the drafters and this committee reflect the understanding that there is some idea or understanding about what arthritis or arthritic conditions mean in the workers' compensation system and the case law, and an intent that they just carry forward with whatever they understand those meanings to be. Nothing in this statute changes the pre-existing usage of the phrase arthritis or arthritic conditions in the current workers' comp system. There was no consensus to change it to either restrict it or expand it. Other thoughts on Section 1. The worker provision was added that was discussed by John Schultz that was amended into the bill again, the addition to the worker definition. That is not a change in the substantive law. That's just codifying case law that's been true for years in workers' compensation. It was just added to the definition section, if the court wonders why, to keep from having to keep repeating it everywhere else it might matter in the Act. It was just brought to the beginning. And that's why that change was made. And finally, this section incorporates a new phrase to represent an old concept, and it's the concept of the onset of a medical condition or of a claimed disease condition or of a worsening. And that language was selected because the courts have recently interpreted in Safe versus Cessnan to talk about that point in time where a particular medical condition doesn't begin but gets to the point where it requires treatment or causes disability, which is the definition of a compensable condition in the first place. If a condition doesn't require treatment or doesn't cause disability, it isn't compensable. So that's the touchstone. Safe versus Cessnan is the referent. That's the source the court should look at in defining that phrase, or at least if they're wondering why that ambiguous phrase, or what was on people's minds when they used that ambiguous phrase. That's all of my commentary on Section 1. My commentary on the other sections will not be nearly as long, so I'd urge you to answer any questions that you have.
Mr. Keene, I just have a process question.
Sure.
I guess I'm a little bit out of the loop on this, but your analysis, as you're presenting it now, is done just solely on from your perspective, or is this done from the perspective of MLAC?
Last time I had a discussion like this, I made it into one of the Court of Appeals judges' lectures at the school on legislative history, so let me be very clear about my understanding of my role here. I was invited and asked by Senator Durfler and the chair, as a person with experience in knowing what the courts find to be ambiguous and on how to get it on the record, and also as a close observer of this process from the very beginning to watching the language chosen and what went into choosing it and not choosing it, to try to add as evidence of the intent behind it my observations of what was intended and why it was used. And the courts will find it as persuasive or not persuasive as they believe it they should. But this is as close as we can get to the nebulous concept of giving them evidence of intent behind words. And your questions will also very much highlight that with the court, so please feel free to ask it.
Right. I mean, that is the reason I'm asking it, is that I guess I don't want, because I'm not an attorney and I don't understand worker comp law, I don't want a judge to rule that there was somehow acceptance of the analysis simply because we heard it, I guess is the point I'm trying to make. And I also wanted to clarify, you know, for whom you were speaking.
Sure.
So I could have that kind of straight in my head. I just wasn't sure.
Sure.
I don't know if you were part of the MLOC process or if we're not.
I was just a close observer and also was retained on the management side of the group of six to monitor the language and help come up with language. And I actually, when the original bill came out and needed to be redrafted, the LC-606C, I drafted the template and then watched all of the changes that have been made since very closely. And knowing I was going to be asked to do this, tried to understand why and be able to offer it here. I should also add that I went through my testimony in pretty good detail with John Schultz, and most of the things I've mentioned, not all. I also have checked with other members of both the claimant side and with other technicians, and I'm trying to play this down the middle and just anticipate questions and answer honestly with what I perceived to be the reasons, so that if the court faces a choice between no evidence of intent and some, this might help come out with decisions that are closer to the intent that the group actually had when they wrote it.
But, Mr. Chair, I guess, again, I guess I want to be really clear.
Sure.
You're an employer side attorney, though, in this process, is that right?
Well, in this process, I'm a private citizen. I mean, yes, I definitely represent insurers and managed care organizations.
Okay.
But I'm not testifying as an advocate here today.
I understand,
you have to be on one side or the other to be an expert in this, unless you're working with the department, in which case, you know, or the board, in which case they can also provide insight, but I have tried to check it with everybody.
Yeah, it's not like biology, is it?
No, I think part of it, too, is just the experience I had watching the mistakes we made come to light and get beaten, you know, into our heads after 1990 and 1995, and so trying to help, you know, learn from that process.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Section 2 changes the burden of proof. It was intended that this language, burden of proof, the Supreme Court has actually said is kind of outdated. They now call it the burden of production, and it was intended to do just that. It will change the order of presentation of evidence when the affirmative defense of major contributing cause is offered in these cases. It is intended to set up a procedure that is parallel to affirmative defenses in civil cases and not just create a presumption that's different than the current presumption in the law. In fact, the committee members were offered language that would simply have created a presumption of compensability, and they turned it down in favor of actually changing the burden of proof or production. Section, any questions on that?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to go back to section 1 if you could.
Okay.
Are you saying that the lengthy analysis of pre-existing conditions applies equally to injuries and occupational diseases?
Some aspects of the changes do, some don't, and that's the bill is structured so that some of the things they agreed to change will apply in both cases, but in particular, the reference to the need for something to be previously symptomatic or treated doesn't apply to occupational disease claims and definitely doesn't apply to arthritis claims involving pre-existing arthritis or arthritic conditions, and for the record, I believe there was an intent when they said arthritis or arthritic conditions to include both arthritis in the main and conditions incidental to or associated with arthritis in the degenerative joint structures or directly related to the condition of arthritis.
Thank you.
Section 3 creates a new kind of benefit that will supplementary temporary disability benefits that will unfortunately and inevitably be termed STD benefits. The guiding principle here is that the sole intent of that was observed during this process was to create a supplemental benefit totally limited to the calculation of time loss benefits. It is to be paid and administered by the department or at the option and a self-insured employer or employer insurer, but it has absolutely no let me say this very clearly. A worker's eligibility for the supplemental time loss benefits absolutely has no impact on the processing, criteria, or eligibility for any other kind of benefit in the system. It is solely supplemental and to the side. In particular, it was not intended to affect their loss history for rating purposes, their liability on the claim. It is not intended to change anything in the other statutes, and nothing was changed in the other statutes governing return to work, claim closure, vocational assistance, or aggravation rights. Nothing in those statutes was changed, and everywhere the phrase return to work is used in those statutes and matters, it continues to refer to what it has always referred to, which is returning to work with the job at injury. It's not intended to affect any of those things or medically stationary dates. It just creates an additional supplemental benefit to what is already there. I would note, too, that the language connotes a clear intent to basically set up a razor wave situation. The worker has the opportunity to bring the fact that they worked two jobs to the employer within 30 days of the injury and also to bring some verifiable documentation of that within the 30 days. Once they do that, forever on their claim into the future, their time loss is going to be higher than it would be under current law, but they do bear the responsibility to get this information to the insurer in a timely manner, and it's set up in a way so that they don't have to rely on people from the second or third job communicating it to the insurer. They can obtain it, and forward it. They don't have to be put in a catch-22 situation, but they do bear responsibility, or once the 30-day window comes and goes, that opportunity will not be there anymore, and that was fairly clear in the language. And finally, the word initial claim is used in this statute, and it is rarely used in the statute. I was wondering if it was ever used in the statute before, but it's certainly not defined. But the department rules define initial claim as the very first claim for a medical condition, not aggravation, not new medical conditions, just the original work injury claim or disease claim. So they didn't see a need to define it. But if they find it ambiguous, look to the department rules. They already define it. Questions? I'm going to skip to Section 7. Making good time. In Section 7, there's a sizable block of language deleted from pages 20 and 21. Except for changing the response time to 60 days for new medical condition claims and omitted medical condition claims, the deletion of that language was not intended to have a substantive effect. It was just picked up and consolidated into a single statute, which is the new Section 10. So that new medical conditions and omitted medical conditions now have a single procedure for being brought to the attention of the insurer and processed, and the criteria are all in one combined statute. They were scattered in several different provisions before. Also, there's no intended substantive effect on the eligibility for attorney fees with regard to those claims. Nothing was changed. It was just reorganized. I would note that in Section 9, I believe it's page 26, there's another one of those glitches that will need to be changed. The reference to 60 days for responding to, or to 30 days for responding to omitted medical condition claims will need to be changed to 60 to conform with other changes that were already made. And this is just another one of those things that pops up as you're reading it closely. And so there's really no one at fault. It's just It just got through the works, and it could be fixed here or in the House.
Where was that, Jerry?
Let me find the page number for you.
Page 25, page 26, that we said.
Right, line 25, within 30 days, to conform with all of the other changes, would need to be 60 days. And that could happen here or in the House. I just wanted to call it to someone's attention because it creates a discrepancy between sections that would need to be interpreted otherwise. Section 10 is where we took all the new language, all the old language, and put it for the new medical condition and omitted medical condition claim processes. Again, it was a reorganization. Subsection 3, however, does give what has been called the Johansson fix. And I think it's been adequately explained previously. I just wanted to clarify for the courts that the phrase right under 656.273 refers to the five-year period. Everybody in workers' comp knows that, but the fact that it's commonly known doesn't always mean that courts will recognize it, so I've stated it blatantly on the record. Section 11 actually posed more problems because I think less attention was paid to it. It's kind of highly technical. It involves changes in the own motion statute, some of which are incidental to the Johansson fix, but more of them are incidental to changing the criteria for reopening a claim and changing the benefits that can be paid once a claim's aggravation rights have expired, these five-year rights, and it passes into what we call the board's own motion under 656.278. I just wanted to clarify some points without belaboring it, but there are certain places where I'm sure the courts will have questions about what was intended, and I'd just like to lay out my understanding of that. First of all, there's a new element for reopening own motion claims. It requires that a worsening of the worker's compensable condition result in the inability of the worker to work. I want to be very clear that that didn't mean total inability. The worker will also qualify if it's a partial inability to work, basically tracking the right to temporary total or temporary partial disability. That shouldn't be construed against the worker more broadly than was intended. It wasn't intended to require a worker to be completely disabled before they could be opened in on motion, and I wanted to make that clear. Also, there's no intended impact by these changes to change the board's current practice of when an own motion claim is brought to their attention, deferring a reopening if there is any question or dispute about the surgery or hospitalization, or now this new in lieu of hospitalization treatment that it talks about. Sometimes that treatment is proposed, And if it is agreed that that treatment is going to be allowed, there will be a period of time loss that needs to be paid under own motion and perhaps permanent disability. But sometimes the insurer or employer has a question about whether the treatment involved is reasonable and necessary, is effective, is effectual, or in compliance with the rules. The way the statute is now structured, and I'll clarify this later, the current procedure that is stated in the rules for allowing that question to be decided by the department needs to take place before the board will act on an own motion reopening. Get all of the questions about whether the surgery is going to be paid for out of the way, then look at whether the claim qualifies for own motion. The board does that now. None of the language changes here were intended impliedly, you know, intentionally or unintentionally, to get rid of that practice by the board. Keep its flexibility to do that. This language was also written and will now become more important because of the reimbursability provisions. There will be a lot more of these claims and a lot more money at stake, so now we have to be a little clear about what's assumed in this language. There is an assumption that with use of the phrases like physician authorization for time loss and other language that imports concepts from the regular time loss rules, there is an assumption that the ordinary rules governing and limiting or controlling or conditioning time loss payments will equally apply to time loss reopenings under the own motion statute, in particular the retroactive medical authorization limited to 14 days. That could matter in these cases. The way the statute is now written, and to the extent there's an ambiguity, observe no intent to change that law. And finally, there's an ongoing, not dispute, but tension between the department and the board, because the board has jurisdiction over reopening claims on own motion, but the department has custody of the funds that the insurers are reimbursed out of once that occurs. And own motion benefits are fully reimbursable from the worker benefit fund. Language was in here at one point that would have allowed the insurer or self-insured employer to be caught between the department and the board, with the board ordering payment, but the department denying repayment, reimbursement, based on the same fact that they just disagreed on. The language has been clarified, and we need to make a very clear record that there is no intent to remove any of the board's current jurisdiction over causation and worsening issues and move it to the department, and no intent to create an overlap. The line is there under current law and was intended to be retained. And that is equally true for claims which the insurer voluntarily reopens. Under the new changes, if an insurer voluntarily reopens a claim for own motion to pay time loss to a worker without waiting for the board to order it, this language clarifies that that money is to be reimbursed by the department from the worker benefit fund. If there is a dispute about whether the claim ought to be reopened voluntarily or through the board, the statute retains in the parties the obligation to bring it to the board's attention and have the board decide it before the matter gets paid and then is subject to reimbursement before the department. 11A is just language is basically the same principles clarified in that language. By the way, there's an ambiguity, Senator Harper. I'm used to
that. Fisher taught him that trick.
I thought perhaps he learned it from the Court of Appeals. They do that to me all the time.
Maybe it's about you, Mr. King.
You know, I try to keep it from being about me. There is a possibility in this statute that the courts could determine that somehow a voluntary reopening constitutes a waiver by the insurer of challenges, other issues that might have come up. And I wanted to just say that the new statutes are silent on that. There's some language taken out that made it clear under the old law. It hasn't been replaced. It may or may not be that there's a waiver. It was not addressed in the hearings of other defenses. I'm just only going to point out to the courts that it may be covered under 656.26810, which says payment of compensation doesn't constitute a waiver of the right to contest underlying entitlement. I'm not positive that does it. I'm just giving my objective viewpoint that there's an issue here. I'm not sure it's not worth the committee's time to do it. It's going to be very rare, but it is an issue, and I'm just pointing it out to the courts that there's a way to resolve it under 26810. Section 12, page 30, modified work offers. This statute sets up a number of criteria, alternative criteria, for situations where a worker is offered modified work, and if the offer falls outside of these criteria, the worker can refuse without an impact on their time loss benefits. The way it's drafted, there are ors and multiple ors and ors within ors that raise the possibility of confusion on the part of the court. It's very, very difficult to draft. I'm just going to offer this guiding principle. With regard to assigning the worker to a work site, the guiding principle here was that the offer must involve work at a site that is consistent with what the worker agreed to, was subject to, or had been engaging in before he was injured or she was injured. Basically, whatever was happening before at the job with regard to one site or multiple sites, if a return to work offer is at a different site and that is within what was previously arranged, agreed, discussed as part of their arrangement, then it will comply with this section and the offer may not be refused. In particular, the language in paragraphs B and D were intended, and it was assumed, would cover the situation involving temporary worker companies and worker leasing agencies, who routinely remain the employer while they send workers out to different employers in different places to do different jobs on a temporary basis, on a non-permanent basis. It was intended that a leasing company or temporary worker company could offer modified work at a different site than the job at injury, and that this language would permit that. To the extent it's ambiguous, there was clear intent in the testimony that they thought that was covered. This section also talks about worker depositions during the reconsideration process. The admissibility language that was added in the most recent draft, allowing for admissibility of a deposition at hearing, even if it wasn't available for the reconsideration proceeding, is intended to track the same kind of provision that applies to medical arbiter exams that don't get conducted in time for the reconsideration proceeding but are nevertheless admissible at the hearing. The language now clarifies that no attorney fees are available to either party for the services during these depositions. It clarifies what costs are available. And note that it's the worker's option to ask for these, that the employer does not have the option to ask for the deposition. It is the way it's worded, it is only the worker's option. Section 13, worker arbiter exams. The statute premises a request on the timely filing of a request for hearing of a compensability denial that was based on the IME. This is loaded with ambiguity. First of all, where it's not ambiguous is in that it states the timeliness of the filing of the request for hearing is to be determined under 656.3191A. It's a specific reference. The time period mentioned there is 60 days. Second, it specifically references compensability denials. This does not occur when it's a responsibility denial or a subjectivity denial. It's a particular situation. Compensability denials are going to be the ones that rely on medical evidence, and it's limited to those. Not clear in the language, but discussed in the proceedings with these issues. One, there was discussion that there was an intent that when the worker asks for an arbiter exam, that it be given what's called equal dignity with the exam that was performed at the request of the insurer that the denial came from. So if the insurer obtained a panel exam involving two or three different insurers or doctors, the worker is entitled to have an examination of equal dignity, of equal type. If the insurer had a particular kind of specialist involved, then the exam requested by the worker should have that same equal dignity specialist. If it was a records review, it was intended that the worker obtain the same. The language doesn't say that. It was just discussed in committee, and I wanted to bring that out for the courts as part of the discussion in the background. And also, it was discussed that one of the conditions is that the attending physician of the worker not have concurred with the insurer's IME. That isn't fleshed out. There was a sense that what that meant was that if the doctor disagreed in part or with all of it, that it didn't have to be a total disagreement before the worker's entitled. It could be a partial disagreement, but that the disagreement by the attending physician had to be on the medical reason that was offered by the IME doctor that was the basis for the denial. The doctor can't just disagree that the worker is 38 years old and correct it, but then agree with everything else and have that be a non-concurrence that would trigger an arbiter's exam. It's got to be on a material aspect of the IME and basically related to the basis for the denial. Two things that were not discussed, and there is no guidance for the courts, and I'm just throwing it wide open. One, there is no mechanism for disputes about whether or not an IME is available to the worker here or meets the criteria. The department's going to have to just make it up. But it definitely is the department's jurisdiction and not the board's. And second, there is no discussion of how to reschedule or deal with situations where the worker asks for these and then for some reason doesn't show up. The worker's going to have to deal with those in the rules, payment, rescheduling, things like that. No discussion anywhere about that to guide the courts. The department will have to come up with its own thoughts. Section 14, I'm almost done here. This is the section on interim medical services, and obviously has been the object of a lot of discussion and a lot of talk. There's a number of very, very potentially important issues that are going to have to be addressed by the courts or in further drafting. One is there's a potential disconnect between the period of time, the triggering date, that starts the worker's entitlement to payment for these interim medical services after they file a claim but before it's accepted or denied. That starting date is referred to as the date that the employer has notice of the claim. Later on, it says that the insurer must guarantee payment for all time lost between notice or knowledge of the claim or injury and moving on. Those two things have been interpreted differently in the courts. It's a disconnect. It needs to be conformed to each other. I think that can be done in the House, but I wanted to call it to the attention. There was an intent that those two periods of time be the same, that the period that triggers the notice and response be the same as the period of time for which the insurer is responsible for interim medical services, so that those two match up. Second, the most recent changes definitely adopt the criteria and procedure by which medical treatment that is prescribed can be looked at by the department to make sure it is in compliance with the rules and the statutes that govern medical treatment before it is paid for. The guarantee is in place, but under 327 procedures, the payment is stayed if the medical treatment is challenged while the department, through its medical review unit, and Nancy Bieber, who was here earlier, supervises that part of the department, looks at it and makes a decision. This is exactly the same as the law involving all other medical services on accepted claims, and the recent changes make clear that that's how this is to proceed. It also makes clear that the workers' comp fee schedule applies to these services, and there was no controversy about that. And this provision also adds some provisions that might be considered insulting to some of the doctors. It tells them to cooperate and return to work, and it tells them to issue first medical reports within 72 hours. I'd just like to make a record that the rules already require that, and doctors already do that. Now it's in the statute, but it was in the rule. This is not anything new. There's no new requirement or burden on the doctors intended by this. Finally, with regard to effective dates, I was a little surprised we didn't see more discussion from Mr. Schiltz. I think because things basically people got tired of talking about it and things came lined up pretty clear on the effective dates. But I did want to clarify that despite the lack of language specifically on point, there was no intent anywhere that these effective dates would in any way put in jeopardy litigated rulings or decisions that have already gone through the administrative or litigation process and become final and weren't appealed. The fact that some of these things are going to apply to all injuries regardless of date of injury is subject to a limitation that I think is just basically flat out constitutional with regard to separation of powers. I don't think the legislature can order the courts to undo a final order. But to the extent that there's some thought that they could, there was clearly no intent of that expressed anywhere in the proceedings. Senate Bill 369 in 1995 actually included a phrase that I thought was unnecessary, but made that very clear. That wasn't included here, but I did not understand the proceedings that anybody intended these changes to allow anybody on either side to go back and reopen issues or findings that the courts would consider what we call res judicata or subject to collateral estoppel because they're final and the chance for appealing them has come and gone. I'm still with me, Senator Corcoran?
I am.
Appreciate your patience very, very much. Thank you. This kind of testimony does provide invaluable help later on when the lawyers and judges are all thrashing around trying to figure out what in the world were they thinking. And this way they can say, oh, they were thinking this? Oh, clearly they didn't think about that at all. We'll just have to come up with something.
Thank you. And just let me point out for the record that this was done also in
369
in 95 to help clarify the record, and it has been very helpful to all parties involved in workers' compensation, Senator Deckert and Senator Corcoran.
Given that it's his anniversary, would you like to...
Not till Saturday, buddy. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jerry, a question about the Employer Liability Act. With the date changed in the revisions, and I was trying to get to it in here, was the date changed, and if so, and moved back,
January 1st is still the date, isn't it?
So was there any, I guess the question is, was there any change in the date at all from day one in this process to today? And if so, would that affect any litigation that is either now occurring or, say, a worker who would be injured 2 weeks ago, since they have the two-year time clock running on them, how would this affect them?
I have to say I'm no ELA expert, so I kind of understand statute of limitations in this clause. As I understand it, it's only going to apply to actions that are filed on January 1st, and that's when the statute of limitations runs, so it really can't affect anything before that. It would be a physical impossibility. There was discussion of having it take effect no matter when they were filed, have it take effect for everything that was still waiting to have a complaint filed on January 1st. And then there was discussion of compromising and saying, well, how about moving that to July? And then I think let's just make it clean and break. And as I understand it, this was consistent with what most of the Gang of Six remembered the intent was, that the new rules of the game start once you file your action.
So, Mr. Chair, just for...
You know, let me correct that. Yeah, I'm going to be very careful about this because I want to make sure I was... You know, I'm not sure that the answer I just gave you is right. I have to apologize. I have to back up on that. If it applies to actions that are filed on or after January 1, then it would relate back to injuries that occurred sometime during, before January 1. And so anything that's filed then could be a date of injury that occurred earlier. But you know, the lawyers know that whether they file it before or after January 1 is going to determine what rules apply. And so lawyers have from now until January 1 to file anything that they want to have fall under the old rules. Does that answer the question?
I guess just so for clarity and...
Yeah. Oh, I'm not sure I even achieved clarity, so please help me.
First, for clarity, the date has not been changed. I'm just looking through and I'm trying to find if any date was changed in terms of the ELA.
You know, I think that the discussions I heard always referred to January 1, but to be honest, they kept deferring this part of the bill. I'm not sure.
Gary?
Yeah.
John?
Oh, help me, John.
And I think we also have Mr. Egan, is it?
Go ahead. Well, let's let John, if John can answer it.
Mr. Chair, Senator Deckert, this date is new. The original version of the bill.
What page and line are you on, John?
The one I'm looking at right now is the -1 version, and I'm on page 47. And it is basically the provisions that refer to the ELA start on line 17 and basically run down to line 24. And the original date... I'm sorry, Senator.
We have different, I believe.
Do you have the -4s?
Sure.
So that's what we adopted, so we should be speaking to the -4s.
Okay. Well, the question, Mr. Chair, the question I was attempting to answer is has there been a change in the date?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And from the -1s, there has been. Okay. And that would have just had this, basically, my understanding is the ELA provisions would have been effective upon the effective date of the act. And the change is that most of the bill now becomes effective or has an operative date on January 1st, 2002. So the date has been moved back that this would be effective. And I think everything else that Mr. Keene addressed from the point of saying he needed to correct what he had said, I think is correct.
I stand corrected.
You corrected yourself, I thought.
Good, sir. Senator Deckert?
Yes, it is, Mr. Chair. So my question is, I guess two-part. One is, what was the rationale for the change? And then secondly, in the same regards, is how would that affect someone who may have been injured prior, obviously, to January 1st, 2002, but the time clock has started for them to file their claim, and they have yet to do it, but they're still within the two-year window. How would this change affect their abilities and access to the courts?
Would you prefer I do the rationale?
Oh, go ahead.
That I might be able to help more with that. Basically, the rationale for the change, Mr. Chair and Senator Deckert, came from a discussion that MLAC directed us to have with a subgroup of MLAC and members of the public regarding trying to determine effective and applicability dates for the portions of the bill. This was at the end of that day that we had the discussion. This was the one area that we did not have settled with the work group. There were three different options considered for the ELA, but there was definitely a feeling in the room from many members that were there that they did not feel like they had sufficient authority to make the decision and referred us back to the original task force and group of six. I talked to Mr. Bob Shipwreck and Mr. Dan Harmon, who were most intimately involved in the negotiations in regard to this particular piece of the bill. Both had the same memory of what they felt that they agreed to during the original task force, which was that the ELA provision should take effect with the rest of the provisions of the bill, and that it should apply to bills filed on or after that date.
Bills or claims?
Excuse me, I'm sorry. Claims or causes of action.
So, Mr. Chair, just I guess my concern and is that if there's any retroactivity to it, either because of that two-year window, that you would have folks that would be their access would be being affected by this decision because of a retroactive nature, even though the date is set forth and consistent. And I guess that's just a concern that I would voice. And I don't know if you're able to speak to
Senator Deckert. I think your observation is points out one of the difficulties that the group was having in terms of trying to set a date. There were definitely concerns inside the group about this very issue. And what the issue basically points out is that for somebody who may have been injured, let's pick a date, let's say on June 1st, 2000, and they do not file their cause of action until February 1st, 2002. They're still within that two-year window of opportunity, but what will happen is the new law will apply. Now, I think it's important to point out that the new law does not eliminate Employer Liability Act claims or actions. It limits them.
Mm-hmm.
So you're exactly right. There are people where they're going to have an effect based on the filing date of the claim or action. Jerry, can you
add? No, I think there was a consideration of the pros and cons, and they had to pick a point, and they wanted to pick one that everybody would know was coming in advance, and if they wanted to affect their standards that would apply, it would be controlled by when they filed their complaint, and there's a lot of time between now and January to get that done. And so I think they thought that kind of answered the fairness concern, and I'm sure that to the extent they're represented by lawyers, the bar is going to be broadcasting this too to kind of prevent malpractice claims from ones that are filed too late.
Mm-hmm. And just one final question, Mr. Yes. Chair. Do you know of any cases that are outstanding that would get caught up in their court cases or pending litigation that would be caught up in this change of date?
If the complaint hasn't been filed yet, then litigation wouldn't have started.
So nothing that you know of?
Mr. Chair and Senator Deckert, not that I'm aware of, but again, I'm sure there are people who have injuries
mm-hmm.
today who have not filed a cause of action in the court, and those are the people who are at risk in this particular instance. And the risk is that are they going to fall into the existing law or the new law?
If I might, Mr. Chairman, one aspect of Section 12 that ties into effectiveness and effective dates I neglected to mention, I was asked to mention this actually by the department, was that the changes with regard to modified work offers and the ones that the new conditions that need to be made, there was no intent that if a worker is in a job now, they've already accepted an offer that didn't meet those conditions, that they would now be able to quit. That the new criteria for offers would apply to offers made after the law took effect. And to the extent that's not clear in the effective dates, again, we've made the record.
Okay. Senator Clark, can you still have a question?
Yes. Mr. Keene, back to Section 2 for a moment, please.
Sure.
With regard to the burden of proof on issues of compensability, would you agree that the claimant ultimately must carry the burden to prevail?
Well, now there's two aspects of every claim. There's the main claim, and then there's a defense. And the worker must establish compensability of the work injury involved under all of the traditional standards. And under current law now, the worker would also have to overcome by a preponderance any suggestion or evidence that it combined with a pre-existing condition and was less than the major contributing cause of it. Now the worker proves and goes first at the hearing and proves the compensability of the claim in chief, I guess I'll call it. Then if the insurer believes they can prove facts that would basically defeat the claim, they have the burden to prove that. So I don't know if the word affirmative defense is one you've heard before, but the employer has the burden of proof on its affirmative defense, and if the evidence is equally balanced, the employer loses on the affirmative defense. So I have to answer your question that way without just a yes or no.
Okay. And, Mr. Chair, if the employer or the insurer gives evidence of a pre-existing condition previously unaddressed in a hearing, then the claimant must rebut that evidence to prevail?
Say it again, please.
If the employer gives evidence of a pre-existing condition previously unaddressed in a hearing, then the claimant must rebut that evidence to prevail.
I'm sure that the question is getting to something that I'm not understanding.
I think it has to do with the injured worker's ability to cross-examine.
Oh, they definitely. The way it works is on the affirmative defense with regard to was a pre-existing condition the major contributing cause of disability or need for treatment. On that fact, the employer has the burden of proof under this change. The employer would go forward with its evidence. Here's my evidence that it is the major contributing cause. The worker cross-examines that evidence.
Okay.
Then the worker puts on their evidence of why it's not the major contributing cause, and the employer cross-examines that evidence. Then the employer gets the last word on the affirmative defense. Would not be able to go back into the compensability of the main injury just on whether or not a pre-existing condition was the major contributing cause. At a hearing, the employer would have the last word. This happens in other cases. Right now, there's an affirmative defense involving alcohol in the statutes, where if the employer believes the major contributing cause of an injury was illicit drug or alcohol use, they go first and last on that issue. Also, burden of proof on backup denials where the employer tries to take back an acceptance. It's not a new situation. It's just new in this context. So always the person who bears the burden of proof. Everybody gets to cross-examine everybody. That's what's so wonderful about workers' comp. That's why so many lawyers can make a living at it. But it's a matter of who has the last word at a hearing.
Any other questions? Any other discussion? We have a motion before us to pass
you, Your Honor.
Senate Bill 485 as amended by the committee to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Can I get Senator Atkinson from outside? If there's no further discussion, we'll ask the clerk to call the roll.
Senator Deckard?
Aye.
Senator Gordley?
Aye.
Senator Harper?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Atkinson?
We're looking for him.
Senator Corcoran?
I'm trying to cross-examine myself. I'm an aye.
Senator Atkinson, how do you vote?
No.
Senator Atkinson votes no. Senator Beyer votes aye. Motion hasn't received the required number of votes. Declared passed. And I will carry the bill.
Is that in the number? Hey, here they go.
Thank you very much, everyone, for your work.
As requested. Boy, we're going to get more air in here now.
I'm courtesy of the good senator.
Oh, all that money.
We're still in this
here. Logging this.
Thank you.
It still couldn't answer my question.
Okay, let's forge ahead to the rest of our agenda. Knowing full well that we will be done at 5 o'clock. I got to find my agenda before we can forge ahead. There it is. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 374. Mr. Putman. Well, that really cleaned up the room, didn't it?
Were they all on that bill, too?
Mr. Chairman, 374 was initiated by the Lottery Commission to do a couple of things. Right now, the wording of the law requires that, well, the fire, certain shareholders of businesses that own a retail lottery game have to disclose certain information. And there's no indication as to how much that ownership has to be. On the other hand, the State Liquor Commission currently uses a 10% figure as a measure of how much ownership a stockholder has to have to provide this information. And the Lottery Commission is asking that you adopt into the law that 10% limit. There's also language in the law about being able to terminate a retailer who knowingly allows persons under 21 to participate in video lottery. And then there's a proposed Dash 1 amendment that also prohibits the payment of prizes to persons under age 21 for video lottery, and also prohibits the possession of a lottery ticket by persons under age 18. It's my understanding that the Dash 1 amendment is also supported by the Lottery Commission.
Do we have a sign-up sheet?
Last time I left, we didn't.
You must be here to testify. Why don't you come on forward while we're waiting to get our sheet, see if anybody else wants to talk about it.
No. Who's that? Well, seating is not a thing, John.
Yeah. How the hell do you know? No one
is told. I know. We have these great meetings.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm David Hooper. I'm Public Affairs Manager with the Oregon State Lottery. I am here to testify in support of Senate Bill 374. As Mr. Putnam indicated, Senate Bill 374 proposed amendments to 461-300. That's the section of our chapter of law which regulates how the lottery contracts with retailers who wish to sell lottery products. The amendments that we're requesting to statute in the bill as written fall into four categories, giving the director limited discretion to waive disclosure or require additional disclosure of persons associated with businesses applying for a lottery contract. I've noted in my testimony where those actual amendments appear in the bill. Updating the different types of persons and or entities who must disclose information as part of the business application, conforming our stockholder disclosure requirements with OLCCs, and clarifying in statute that a retail contract may be terminated if a retailer knowingly allows a person under 21 years of age to play video lottery games. I'll give you some details. Current statutes do not allow the director to waive disclosure requirements, even when it is clear the requirement is unnecessarily bureaucratic, perhaps even absurd. We're often required to obtain information by law about applicants and their family members, even when it's clear those persons are not in a position to jeopardize the security and integrity of the lottery. There are clear instances when the director should be able to waive those disclosure requirements. A recent example, we had a retail establishment in which the owner passed away. The business went into a trustee, a trust held by the bank. And by law, because the bank was acting as the trustee for this establishment during the estate proceedings, the president, CFO, CEO of a major bank, its board members all had to provide personal disclosure to the lottery. Clearly, this is an instance where the director should be able to waive that type of disclosure. We already had information about the key persons, the manager, who was operating the business during the interim. Conversely, there are instances when the lottery may encounter a person associated with a business applying for a lottery contract where additional information is necessary to ensure the security and integrity of the lottery. An example is an applicant's live-in boyfriend or girlfriend who has a serious criminal background, has loaned the applicant money, and works in the business. These amendments codify the requirement for that person to disclose to ensure they won't be able to
bring a criminal influence into the operation of that business as a lottery retailer. The second type of amendments are very straightforward. They're simply updating the types of businesses that we've encountered, the positions, the entities that we encountered during the application process. As Mr. Putnam provided to the committee in his summary, we are trying to conform to what degree possible our application processes with those of OLCCs. Their current threshold for publicly traded corporations is 10%. Statute for publicly traded corporations for the lottery is 5%. We'd like to move that up to provide more uniformity between those two agencies. People applying for a lottery contract are oftentimes simultaneously applying for an OLCC license. And then the fourth part is giving us legal grounds as part of our contracting to terminate a contract with a retailer who knowingly allows a person under 21 years of age to play video lottery. And this segues into the Dash 1 amendments that we've worked with Senator Gordley on. And looking at our statutes, we did update the ability through this bill to terminate a contract. However, state law speaks to paying a prize, buying a lottery ticket, or selling a lottery ticket to the age of 18. This was been in the place since 1985. We believe it's the legislature's intent that persons must be 21 years or older to play video lottery games. When the legislature authorized video lottery statutes back in 1991, they limited the placement of terminals into age-controlled areas on OLCC on-premise establishments. You must be 21 or older to be in that establishment or in the portion of the establishment where alcohol is concerned, served. By default, one would assume that the legal age of playing video or receiving a video lottery prize is 21. However, statute still remains at 18 as the threshold, so we would like to update statute to make that clear. The final part of the Dash 1 amendment is that a person under 18 found with a lottery ticket, a Megabucks ticket, a scratch-it ticket, that ticket could be seized. And the same would be true for a video cash slip for a person under the age of 21. That really summarizes the intent of this bill. We see it as housekeeping and technical in its nature. It does not represent any major shifts in policy, and certainly in terms of the age of play, we just want that authority in law to so it's clear that a person under 21 may not play video or receive a prize. Thank you. I'll ask any questions you may have.
Thank you. Questions?
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Senator Harper. Bill, why don't you come up over? Go ahead.
Yeah. Trying to figure out what to say here. The sale of lottery tickets, how do we enforce that now, under 18?
Under 18, all tickets are, of course, sold through retail premises. We train our retailers to basically treat the sale of lottery tickets as they would an alcohol or tobacco product if a person appears to be under 26 years of age. Ask them for ID. If a prize is redeemed at a retailer, the same premise applies there. If they appear to be underage, ask them for ID. Certainly anybody appearing at the lottery to claim a prize is put through that same test. In fact, you know, we ask for identification.
Do you follow-up? Do you do stings like OLCC does?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Harper, at this point, we do not do stings per se.
Okay. One last question, Mr. Chair.
Before you ask that question, what does per se mean?
We don't have an organized program in which we are recruiting people and sending them out in an attempt to have a retailer make an underage sale. However, if we have a field rep in an establishment and they clearly see somebody who appears to be underage trying to purchase a lottery ticket, they may ask the retailer to ask that person for ID. State police do background investigations of people during the contract process, but no, it's not an organized campaign as OLCC.
Okay. Go ahead.
And then in the amendments, we change assure to insure. What does that mean?
Mr. Chair, Senator Harper, that would have been a change made by legislative counsel in the process of drafting these amendments. Legislative counsel felt that insurer instead of insurer or assure was the more appropriate word.
The Judiciary Committee coming out now that when we change a word, it means something to the courts, and they're going to go, I just can't help it. I'm sorry. Okay, thanks. Go ahead, Bill.
For the record, Bill Perry from the Oregon Restaurant Association, Director of Government Relations. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the opportunity. I would like to back up a lot of the things that the lottery has said. This, we feel, is a needed change because there are, in our business, obviously, there's a lot of people that will sell a title or a business and carry the note, and a lot of these are run by management companies, and sometimes when they take them back over, there are small stockholders that have absolutely no management capabilities, and the lottery would be required to do background checks. So this is something that we feel is needed because it, I think, wastes a lot of time and energy of the commission. Also, the movement from 18 to 21-year-olds on the sale of video lottery tickets is sufficient for us because the machines are supposed to be in areas posted no minors, so there should not be anybody under the age of 21 in that area anyway. So with that, we'll just hear and say that we support the bill.
Okay. Questions? Thank you very much. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 374. Open the work session, Senate Bill 374.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 374.
Senator Gorley moves the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 374. Discussion on the motion? Objections? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 374 as amended to the floor of the do-pass recommendation.
Senator Gorley moves Senate Bill 374 as amended to the floor of the do-pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion? For the record, Senator Gordley, you had a bill that was virtually the same as the dash one amendment. Is that correct?
The lottery department asked if I would have the dash one amendment drafted by LCA, and I'm happy to have that done.
Okay.
Yeah,
but you had a different bill also.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Just make sure that I know where that came from. So.
Okay.
Any objections to the motion to move Senate Bill 374 as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation? So ordered. Any volunteers to carry the bill? Senator Gordley, you carry the bill. Okay. We will now open a public hearing on Senate Bill 828. Mr. Putnam, while you're describing the bill, we'll ask Mr. Kruger and Fred Venata and Roxanne Gillespie all to come forward. Do you want to introduce the bill quickly?
Mr. Chairman, 828 and the proposed amendment were at one time part of, or intended to be part of another bill that also deals with the Fraser Certification and Licensure Board becoming semi-independent. And because we're a relating clause, that did not work. So 828 was drafted as a separate bill to allow the licensure board to require additional education to be state certified or licensed. And then, in addition to that, an amendment was proposed also by the supporters of the bill, I believe, to make a modification in how long Fraser records have to be kept.
Okay, well, let's go first.
Mr. Kruger. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Jim Kruger. I'm the interim administrator for the Appraisers Certification and Licensure Board. This bill is intended to provide the board with a tool that will assist in ensuring the professionalism and the expertise of appraisers. Currently, the board does not have authority to require additional education when they determine that a appraiser is deficient in an area of expertise. as a part of the contested case hearing process. However, we do impose that as part of a negotiated settlement, which is the way most of our enforcement actions are closed. But we would like to be able to do that as part of the contested case hearing also in those instances. We found that to be a very effective tool, and I think that most of the appraisers in the state support it, even the ones that's had it imposed on them as part of an enforcement action. That's all I had to say about it. It's a fairly simple bill.
Okay. Who wants to go next?
Thank you. I'm Roxanne Gillespie. I'm a fee appraiser in Eugene, Oregon. I'm also a governor appointment to the Appraiser Certification Licensure Board, and I'm currently the chair of the board. The bill was brought, we support the bill because it allows us an opportunity to grant education instead of a civil penalty only on our, in our enforcement areas. We have found that appraisers that have violated Uniform Standards of Professional Appraisal Practice, which we are here to enforce, will need additional education as opposed to a civil penalty. So it's pretty straightforward. It's, it would help us in our enforcement area. Thank you.
I am Fred Venata, appearing before you on behalf of the Greater Oregon Chapter of the Appraisal Institute, the major association of appraisers in the state of Oregon. Our members have asked me to express to you that they support the bill, and we've heard of no opposition from any of the unaffiliated and other smaller associations. So we would urge your affirmative vote on the measure.
Thank you. Has anyone spoke to the Dash 1 amendments yet?
Mr. Chairman, Jim Kruger, for the record, I, in fact, don't, have not seen a copy of the Dash 1 amendments yet.
Are you talking about 828 or 304?
I'm talking about 828. You guys don't know about that Dash 1 amendment, huh?
No, we've seen the original bill. We have not seen the amendments.
The systems development charge on appraisers.
Oh. How about if we should we go into the next public hearing while you're giving a chance to go? Are you guys the same people who need to talk about the next bill also?
We're familiar with that. I know the history of that. When I see that, I know the history of that language. It was language that was originally suggested by Mr. Kruger and the board that somehow got left out of Senate Bill 304.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And I know that the legislative committee, our legislative committee, reviewed this language and said they had no objection to it.
But it came from Kruger?
So we got a letter here from both Mr. Venata and Mr. Kruger requesting this amendment, so hopefully you are familiar with it.
I don't just make this stuff up.
I don't know. You made up a vote for Deckard and I the other day.
Sure, I did. So I made up not voting for you.
Well,
I apologize for that. And for the record, I've corrected my staff major summary
on
that.
Go ahead and put me as a no on 45. And
what?
So you both support the Dash 1 amendment also?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Anyway, why don't you stay there if you're talking. We'll talk about 304 in just a moment. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 828 and open a work session on Senate Bill 828.
Mr. Chair,
we have a Dash 1 amendment.
Move the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 828.
Senator Gorley moves the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 828. Discussion on the motion. Objections? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 828 to the floor with the due, as amended, to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Gorley moves Senate Bill 828 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion. Objections? So ordered. We want to carry that one.
I'll carry it. You know, I got to help the bankers out last week. I'd love to help Mr. Venata out. I've never got to do anything for him.
It's all yours, Mr. Perkins.
Okay. Thank you. We'll work closely on my testimony on this, okay? I got like a 30 zip on the one for the bankers. So we should do at least that well, Fred.
Close the work session on Senate Bill 828. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 304. Mr. Putman.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Senate Bill 304, I believe you've had testimony on before, but at the time you heard it, you didn't have the printed LC amendments to it. We have those. That should be in your packet. And we also try to distribute a handed gross version of that. The changes really are quite simple on the amendment. Cut the size of the board from 10 to 7.
Okay. Does anyone want to speak to the bill or the...
Fred Venata on behalf of the Appraisal Institute. I think we all three testified on the bill when it was before you before. There was no opposition to it. We believe the bill is ready to move. We would encourage you to adopt the Dash 1 amendments and move the bill. I believe it has a subsequent referral on it.
The bill has a referral to Ways and Means. We're in work session there? Not yet. We're in public hearing, but we're about to go into work session.
Mr. Chairman, the fiscal statement that you had earlier has not been revised, and when it is revised, the amount of savings that is shown in that fiscal impact statement should go up a little bit, since there are only going to be 7 board members instead of 10. But I don't have that. My belief, it's not a barrier to your passage at this point.
Okay. I don't even see the fiscal in my packet.
Why the referral? What that means here? The Ways and Means.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Harper, it's my understanding that Ways and Means is kind of shepherding the process by which some state agencies are wishing to become semi-independent. That's an assumption on my part. I haven't been told that in just so many words.
The bill has a prior reference from the president's office, so.
Yeah, I can go down and ask him.
But it has a fiscal that will be a savings, overall savings.
Well, the fiscal impact, Mr. Chairman, Senator Harper, was with the original hearing. And all I'm suggesting is the Dash 1 will change it just a little bit.
I don't know if you've handed that out to us. I don't think we've seen the fiscal yet.
No.
I haven't seen the fiscal yet.
Well, it's showing a savings of $910,000 in BCBS funds.
Is that just a transfer because of...
And it's the transfer. And then they are fully funded from their own fees. And I believe the bill has the fee structure in control of the new semi-independent board.
That is correct.
I said that backwards. The fee structure is not in control of the board. It's the board that's in control of the fee structure.
Okay.
No, not the right person.
Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 304. Do you have a question?
If we could get a copy of that.
I'm sure we could.
Certainly.
We will.
Do that right now.
We will slowly go into work session if you're giving us a copy of the... That's it. You got it.
On the 16.
Certainly. Who else wasn't here on Senate Bill 16?
I wasn't.
Do you want to vote?
Sure.
Senator Deckert moves to... We suspend the rules to allow Senators Deckert and Harper to vote on Senate Bill 16. Is there any objection? So ordered. Senator Deckert, how do you vote?
Aye.
Senator Harper, how do you vote?
Aye.
Both vote aye. And as we're standing at ease, Pam.
back from recess, and we will open a work session on Senate Bill 304.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Gordley.
I move the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 304.
Senator Gordley moves the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 304. Discussion on the motion. Objections? So ordered. Senator Gordley.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 304 as amended and by prior reference to Ways and Means.
Senator Gordley moves Senate Bill 304 as amended by prior reference and by prior reference to the Committee on Ways and Means. Is there discussion on the motion?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Corcoran.
I just want to put on the record that that there is a fiscal impact in fears of $900,000, but it's other funds. It is not general fund. Is that correct?
There should be a savings of $910,000 on also
transfer.
Actually, it's $971,000 fiscal and savings of.
But it's business fees and licenses.
Right. It's not general fund.
It's not general fund. Is that correct?
But okay. I think the Ways and Means Committee has to know that they have to back this money out of the DCBS budget because this will be a semi-independent board now. They will, and we will no longer review their budget.
Sure. I just wanted it on the record that there was not a physical impact out of the general fund.
That is correct.
Given the cheapness of some of the people in this building, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for that.
You're welcome, Mr. Chair.
Are there any other...
Just here to help. Just here to serve, sir.
Okay. Any other discussion on the motion to move the bill to Ways and Means? Any objections? So ordered. Just going to Ways and Means. Thank you, many members. We are adjourned.